Oregon state level, and we could just show other states there's a better way of doing this that engages more people and makes our democracy more reflective.
I understand there's a county in Oregon that's already taking on this step to change their electoral voting
system? So right now, Benton County, Oregon, is putting an initiative on the November ballot. So they're gathering signatures right now, and they have some great support from really respected leaders in the community. And the initiative would make it so that Benton County councilors would be elected by instant runoff voting, that one where you get to rank your choices so that if your first choice gets eliminated, your voice is still heard.
Do you know how that came about? Why they decided to get that on the ballot?
I don't know the full history, but I know that there is somebody there who has been in the state legislature who was frustrated with how things work and how elections worked, and so has been looking to make a change. And this was a moment in Benton County where they had an opportunity to do that on the ballot. So we hopefully it'll pass, and then at least, you know, Benton County voters will get a chance just to try that out and see, you know, how it feels to get to rank your candidates, and then how those elections feel in terms of if it follows the pattern we've seen, being less negative, more sort of thoughtful and productive, and then how that council ends up looking a little bit more moderate and with, you know, less extremist voices.
If people want to find out more about the series, Archaic Voting Systems, Crippled Democracy, where can they do that, Kristen?
Sightline.org.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamie Haddad.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All-African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All-African People's Revolutionary Party speaking about organizing for Pan-Africanism in Gambia and throughout Africa. Again, that's A Message from the Women of Gambia, a part of the Pan-African Film Festival, Wednesday, May 18th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Room 333 at PSU, 1826 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Welcome to KBOO's 2016 election night coverage, where we will be giving you up-to-minute updates about the current election and those who are running for the election. If you I just want to let you all know, if you haven't voted and you are a listener in Hood River or Philomath, you have until 8 p.m. to drop your ballot off. The following are your options for last-minute ballot drop-offs. In Hood River, at the county election office, there are boxes inside the third-floor election headquarters and also in the ground-floor lobby. That is at 601 State Street, Hood River, Oregon. Their doors are open until 8 p.m. tonight. In Cascade Locks, drop off your ballot at City Hall. Their lobby is open until 8 p.m. tonight. in Benton County, Benton County Courthouse, 120 Northwest 4th Street in Corvallis. The Wells Fargo in Timber Hill Shopping Center, Benton County Sunset Building, 4077 Southwest Research Way. Lincoln Health Center, North Albany Shopping Center, and the Philomath Public Library. Indoor ballot drop boxes can be found at the Corvallis Public Library, OSU Valley Library, the Senior Citizen Center of Corvallis, LBCC Benton Center, and City Limits Market. Good luck and good voting to you all out there in Hood River. And also here in Portland, the final day of voting for the May 17th Oregon primary is here. Voters can drop off ballots in person at any official drop site in Oregon until 8 p.m. tonight. Please note that postmarks do not count. Voters can find the nearest drop site anywhere in Oregon by visiting the Oregon drop box locator by going to sos.oregon.gov or .gov and selecting the drop box locator button on the left hand side of the home page. By this time, all registered voters should have received their ballots. Multnomah County voters who have not received ballots or need assistance should call Multnomah County Elections at 503-988-3720 or visit the elections office at 1040 Southeast Morrison Street, Portland. Voters who have returned their ballots can check their ballot status at www.oregonvotes.gov or by signing up to track your ballot. Secure sites are located throughout Multnomah County, and voters can also drop off ballots in person at any county library. Boxes will be emptied regularly throughout the day and promptly at 8 p.m. tonight. A list of official ballot drop sites in Multnomah County is available online and below. And the Multnomah County Elections Division will begin releasing unofficial results at 8 p.m. tonight at its office on its website at multco.us/elections/results and through its Twitter feed at multco elections. Unofficial election results will be updated on the website throughout election night as additional ballots are counted. If all of this is making your head spin, then you can just keep it tuned to KBOO. We'll be covering the election live between now and 8 p.m., is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'll be speaking with various political parties, nominees, and winners around town, plus airing some interviews from the archive. So, I'm Sequoina.
I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And we're going to be covering the election night tonight and bring you up to date minute results, I guess, until...
The gripping... Portland, Oregon, Hood River, every place that KBOO covers. So
yes,
tonight what we're going to be coming up, we have a whole bunch of interviews lined up for this next hour. We have, first we're going to have Joseph Santos-Lyons from Apano here in Portland. Then we'll have Mary Pivetto, Sean Fleek, Bruce Poinsett, and then we'll have a large interview with Spencer Sunshine. That'll be coming up. And then after that, from 7 to 8 o'clock, we'll have an interview with Simon Tam and Karen Witten. And then KBOO reporter Theo Burke has been just doing this great coverage at the United Methodist Convention that's been happening here in Portland. It's a Methodist convention for the entire Methodist Church that is meeting here. So we'll get an update from Theo. Then back live in studio, we'll have an interview with Emery, who is going to give us some updates about pot legislation around here in Oregon. And then, of course, over the next couple hours, we'll just keep updating with all the results as they come in, as people are dropping those ballots into those drop boxes if you haven't done so yet. So make sure to not put it in the mailbox, but to put it in one of those official drop box or any of those locations that Sequoina listed for us.
Yep.
So I think we got Joseph Santos Lyons already to talk to us.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you, Joseph, for joining us today. Happy Election Day.
Happy Election Day.
So for those who don't know, Joseph Santos Lyons is the executive director for APANO here in Oregon. How is it going over at APANO today?
You know, we wrapped up about a week of get out the vote work, had several dozen volunteers in every night making calls and getting out to canvass in the neighborhoods and doing our work on communications and social media. We're just hoping to see one of the biggest turnouts in the primary election since 2012. And so, we're only about 30% who have voted as of this morning, but most likely about a third of the voters turn out on the last 24 hours. So we're trying to make sure that they know where to get their ballots dropped off, and looking forward to the results.
So at APANO, what are some of the ballot issues that you guys are really paying attention to for this election?
You know, for the primary, we're not taking a position on any of the major measures. The two that we've paid attention to the closest are the Nestle measure around water rights in Hood River and then the gas tax here in the city of Portland. But after studying both the issues, you know, our organization is still a smaller Asian American Pacific Islander advocacy group, and we didn't necessarily see these as top priorities for our communities. We are looking ahead to the 16 elections in the fall, and there's going to be a number of potential both good and bad measures that we're going to be potentially taking positions on.
So what are the issues that seem to matter most to the Asian American community in Portland and Oregon in general?
Well, I think it's tough for me to speak on behalf of the larger Asian American Pacific Islander community, but what I can say is, you know, our communities have grown to over 250,000 here in the state. But still, due to either our citizenship status or our age, only about 70,000 are eligible to vote. So for us on the election side, one of the major issues is making sure that those 70,000 voters are registered to vote. And so we've been working hard both to help see through the full implementation of the new Oregon Motor Voter, which is creating more of a universal voter registration model here, and then making sure that other folks, either newly naturalized citizens and young people, are registered to vote in time to be able to cast their ballots. And then the other piece for us is around education. So many of our voters still may not have a full grasp of our political system. You know, they may have come from other countries, and there also may be language barriers. So we produce, especially around the fall election, the number of materials in language and do sort of grassroots community work through our ballot parties to give folks that information in language.
What measures did APANO take to do voter registration to get people to vote?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the main ways we register voters is in a partnership with the Center for Intercultural Organizing in CAUSA, where we engage with newly naturalized citizens every day when they come out of their naturalization ceremony. And that has led to about 5,000 voters a year being registered. But through the Oregon New Motor Voter Law, we're going to see, you know, probably 50 to 100,000 new folks registered in the state. But that's still going to create gaps for those who are low income, folks of color, and young people who tend to be the most difficult to reach around voter registration. So we're all about making the system and the process easier. You know, around our issues, though, APANO is primarily a racial justice organization, so we're looking at issues through that particular lens. And we're particularly interested in things that impact our children and families. So we are, you know, more narrowly focused than a sort of a more of a mainstream group. But we often find, you know, issues that are either targeting our families because they're immigrants, you know, like back in 2008 when there was an anti-ESL measure that qualified and went to the ballot, and that was how I got involved as a volunteer, to right now we're looking at measures around English only and e-verify around sort of creating it sort of issues for workers to be able to be sort of checked for their citizenship status that we find real threats to our community.
Recently, Mr. Lyons actually a day or two in the scanner, they reported upon being a part of the Portland Public Schools ethnic studies. What's the goal to have PPS have ethnic studies? And, you know, and there was a strong APANO presence there. What's the goal moving forward to ensure that PPS is going to make this happen?
Yeah, I mean, first, we're really thrilled that the APANO youth really led that fight to have Oregon's strongest ethnic studies policy. But now it's really about implementation. And so we're going to be working with the district to create a budget in the next year to be able to resource ethnic studies at all PPS high schools. Longer term, we'd love to see that happen across the state in each of our public school districts. I think on the elections front, we don't have a school board election until May of 2017, mm-hmm. but we're going to be looking and asking candidates their positions on ethnic studies, because in this day and age, you know, you see states that are becoming more diverse, sometimes becoming very reactionary around the diverse communities. But we really want Oregon to be at the forefront of being able to be a welcoming and inclusive state.
And I kind of blindsided you with that question, but I was like, well, you're already here. Let's ask, you know, let's see.
No, it's all good.
Can you anticipate any sort of obstacles implementing that plan to create an ethnic studies curriculum in all of the public schools?
You know, this is really new for Oregon. I mean, I think other states are far ahead. And even though Portland Public Schools is about almost 50% students of color, there really hasn't been an institutional commitment to having really strong ethnic studies across all the public high schools, middle schools, and grade schools. So we imagine a lot of issues just in the sense that this is a very, very new sort of concept, and we may not have all the right sort of either teachers or faculty who are experienced in utilizing the curriculum. But, you know, I think in the big picture, and I think this election and the election in November are going to be real litmus tests. You know, we're constantly fighting for the soul of Oregon. Over the last generation, we've had major attacks on gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender persons. We've had attacks on immigrants. And even though we've been winning, I would say, on the progressive end, some of those fights, it still really feels tenuous. I mean, last election in 2014, we lost the driver's card issue to be able to give all Oregonians, regardless of citizenship, access to the ability to drive. And it passed in Multnomah County. It failed virtually everywhere else in the state. And that creates a legacy and an environment that makes it difficult to pass other good public policy from our perspective that advances racial justice and immigrant rights here in Oregon.
All right. Well, we are running a little bit short on time here, Joseph, but thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time.
In our last minute, I have to ask. We're having
really
a kind
important
of
question.
Important questions happening here, Joseph. You know, our elections here in Portland, we mail in our ballots, so we don't exactly have an election day that's exciting as other states where you get to stand in line and see all these results. So we've been joking that we call this the election fortnight, since it seems to take about 2 weeks for our elections to happen. If you could name this long, drawn-out election process here in Oregon, what would be what you would call it?
Oh, man. There's such a need for same-day registration and being able to postmark your ballot, have it be counted. You know, I do think this is the 4 a.m. election, because we know that a third of the folks don't vote till election day. And so many of us were out this morning at 4 a.m., like Mother Pack, canvassing doors all across Oregon. And I would call this the 4 a.m. election.
Well, thanks very much for answering our question. So once again, that is Joseph Lyons. He's from APANO. He's the executive director. And we really appreciate you speaking with us tonight.
Yes,
so
thank you.
Does this mean you've already turned in your ballot?
Yes, I was an early voter, because if you vote early, you don't get called, because they take your name off of the voted list.
Well, look at that. That's a tip.
Yeah, so all the campaigns are able to access who's voted, who hasn't voted. It's all public record. It doesn't say how you voted, but whether you did. So if you vote early, you won't get all those GOTV calls that sometimes come late at night, early in the morning. So I'm a early first day voter.
They can't call me because they don't have my phone number.
Oh, look at all the tips we're learning right now.
We do always encourage folks who register to vote to put your number down, because sometimes it's helpful to have a conversation about the issues, especially when you can be, you know, called by someone you trust or an organization you trust. Great luck tonight. I'm glad you're doing all these interviews. I'm looking forward to hearing my buddy Simon, who's an incoming board member of Apano, and Sean Fleek from Opal.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Take good care.
You too.
So do we have our next Mary Pivetto? Are all lined up and ready to go? All right. So we have Mary Pivetto here to speak with us. Mary, are you there? Maybe she's not there. Mary?
Hi, Mary. Are you there? Okay. I don't think she's there right now, so we'll probably go back to her in just a few moments. But we are live right now to cover the 2016 election night coverage. We will be going until 8 o'clock?
We're going until 8 o'clock.
We're going to 8, and then we're going online. The party doesn't stop.
Oh, it doesn't stop.
It's going. Yeah. It goes all the way. So look at that. We even got a party going on this room right now.
Somebody's bag is ringing. But it looks like we might... No, not yet. We might, not might, but we're looking forward to having Cameron Winton to talk live with us here shortly, too. So you'll want to stay tuned to hear what he has to say. He's very well known in the community, does a lot of civil work, and so you'll want to stay tuned for that shortly.
And we also have reporters who are going to try to go out to some of the headquarters of some of the officials there and give us some updates and see how that's going. Yeah, it's a whole KBOO News party up in here. We actually have a whole potluck going on.
Up in here? Did you say up in here?
I did. Well, it looks like we have Mary on the line now. Mary, are you there?
I am. How are you?
Good. How are you doing? Thank you, Mary Pivetto, for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Well, happy Election Day to you.
And to you, it's an exciting day.
It's been an interesting year here in Oregon. You know, just recently, I'd love to be able to speak to you about air pollution.
Well, I'm happy for the opportunity. And honestly, yes, for an election year, our timing couldn't have been better to get this on the agenda for this election cycle. I wouldn't have anticipated it being such a big issue, but I think it is.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about what is it that residents are facing right now when it comes to this election? Where can they be seeking some hope?
Well, you know, I think we're facing exactly what we've been facing in the past, which is, you know, air pollution is a really hyper-local issue, and yet we've never had decision makers at the local level with really strong jurisdiction or, frankly, interest in dealing with our local toxic hotspots. And now we do. And so this election cycle, we suddenly have many candidates, just about every single candidate seeking office for local, from Multnomah County through the city of Portland positions, are all calling for, you know, stronger local jurisdiction on air emissions and air pollution. And that's, I think, really great for everybody in Portland. And honestly, I actually think it's really great for everybody in Oregon, because it starts to put some new pressure on the stranglehold in Salem of not dealing with the urban air toxics and the local hotspots.
I guess that's a question that people have about why there's been a lack of action here in Oregon about this air pollution. You know, we hear about Bullseye Glass and all these places, especially on the east side of Portland, that have been polluting. And apparently it's been many years since this all started. Does this happen because of our elected officials? You know, some people are not sure who to point the fingers at.
Well, you know, as is why one of the reasons I always, you know, turn into you guys. You really speak to voices that are often not well heard from. And in the case of air pollution and air emissions regulations and, you know, really the lingering problem of air pollution, you know, it has been a problem that has been widely understood and recognized by communities of color. I mean, going back to the 90s when, you know, Opal and the Environmental Justice Action Committee led by Jerry Sunval Williams during that time, you know, really we're leading the charge to deal with the toxic diesel emissions in our city. And so I do think it's the legacy of continued disparities in our way we address problems in our communities. And so right now what we're facing is suddenly no new information, frankly. I mean, there is some new information about some toxic hotspots, but really in terms of the breadth of the problem, no real new information to the people who have been able to make decisions and have had the power. But it's who is being impacted and affected. There's a whole bunch of new awareness generally, and that is making the political will that just has not existed. This hasn't been a problem of lack of information or lack of understanding of the risk. In fact, even today, the risk of diesel in African-American communities and communities of color, you know, completely dwarfs anything that we've learned about heavy metals in some of these other communities. And I mean by, a, you know, 800 times higher risk of, you know, illness that comes from diesel pollution in African-American communities. But we just didn't have the, the general awareness and the political will.
Yeah, especially we here in KBOO News, we've been reporting about pollution here in Portland, also out in the Eastern Oregon, and just how horrific it's been for communities of colors out there and how disenfranchised their voices have been in these issues.
Yeah, completely disenfranchised. It really has been, you know, where folks, you know, really the there has been no power to the community's concerns. You know, the few and far between, you know, community-driven solutions have been held up by everybody as, you know, wow, you all need to do good neighbor agreements, because that was a recognition that the state and elected leaders were not going to step in to address these issues. And so, yes, these folks out in the Dalles, you know, that are dealing with a really powerful company and their elected officials seems to, seems clear from election donations that, you know, he takes money from, you know, interests that are really associated with that company. I mean, this is the political climate, and that's why these elections and election days matter a lot. And because this has been a political issue, not a technical or information problem issue. And so I'm really excited to see so many candidates coming out in the last few months to say they are on the side of public health and the, you know, and the communities, and they're on the side of stronger air emissions regulations.
And so in the discourse that's happened there, I know there have been at least a couple of mayoral debates about the environment, and it was pretty topical when Ouroboros and bullseye glass were being talked about a lot. What's your take on the type of conversations that are being had? Do they seem satisfactory? Does it seem like they're centering on the most helpful and the most pressing things?
Yeah, I think especially at the city mayoral debates, they are really focused on establishing local jurisdiction on air emissions regulations, which, you know, frankly, if you look across the country, best practices, you will see that the place where air emissions are best regulated are when the control is more local. And so I think that that is really good news for our communities at this point, that there are elected leaders that are they're strongly considering that option. And I think that that's a really important step forward.
And you mentioned earlier diesel pollution in predominantly African-American communities. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because just like this issue in general being sort of invisible, it seems like that particular facet of air pollution is somewhat invisible in a marginalized community.
Yeah, I mean, it has not been invisible to that community. As I said, you know, air quality activism goes back to the 90s, way before I was doing this. You know, Jerry Jimenez was doing this, organizing folks in North Portland around diesel emissions. And they were doing it because of the health disparities that they were also seeing in their communities. And basically, Multnomah County Environmental Health has come out and said that, you know, diesel pollution contributes to the three leading causes of death, as well as some of the leading sort of chronic illnesses that folks face. And those are higher in the communities where the diesel emissions are higher. And so this has not been invisible for these communities at all. I think that they have suffered and been so frustrated by the lack of will for anybody to set a diesel standard in our state. And it's way past time for us to be dealing with this. And you know, sadly, with this added information that's coming out, you know, I think that Oregon Health Authority and other health public health folks are stepping up with better and stronger information. And unfortunately, that information is not pretty. I mean, it is definitely showing the legacy of cancers, specifically like bladder cancers in these communities and in these African-American communities that have lived in these diesel hotspots, who are also, you know, over top of that, are also happen to be like near the Tubman School, the Ouroboros glass manufacturer, also cadmium and arsenic hotspots. And again, those hotspots have been well known since, you know, early 2000, when DEQ was monitoring the air near that site and was picking up cadmium and arsenic, but they couldn't explain where it was coming from. So this has been invisible only to the system and maybe to a large group of Portlanders who see us as green and sustainable. But for the folks that have been most impacted, it hasn't really been that invisible. They've known they've been choking on this diesel for a long time.
Mary?
Yes.
The question I wanted to ask is, do you know what the data is about increased by the current environment? Like, do you know what the increase is of people being sick in these areas that you've mentioned?
Well, so we do know that Oregon Health Authority there's a statewide cancer registry that did affirm that there are higher incidences of bladder cancer in the area near Ouroboros glass. That could, you know, there is also bladder cancer can also be related to diesel emissions. What's interesting to me is that area, though, in the community is also a place, you know, there's so many layers to social injustice, and it's also a community that has been widely displaced over the last decades. It's, you know, it's an area of gentrification as well. And so I know that there's a lot of work happening in the community through neighborhood associations and other work to reach out to the folks who have moved away from those areas and find out more about their experiences, health experiences, and otherwise. And I just have anecdotal information that would suggest that, you know, the cancers have followed people to where they live now. That's what makes all of this data really hard, is because we do tend to be mobile. We do tend to move, whether out of choice or displacement. And so it is very, very difficult to link specific environmental exposures to health outcomes. But I think the data is clear. I think the one beautiful thing about diesel and some of these other air toxics is we know that they are threads across many different wide public health concerns, from heart disease, asthma, cardiovascular, stroke, leading causes of death with cancer, stroke, and heart disease. So if we pulled them out of our environment, we know we would benefit a very wide swath of people.
Well, Mary, we're just about out of time here, but thank you so much for joining us. This has been super enlightening, and it obviously is an incredibly important issue that doesn't seem to be talked about quite enough or quite comprehensively. So,
thank you very much. And I also want to say, I think there's some important elections that are happening for the state legislature, especially in the North Portland, taking Lou Frederick's seat. I think it's really exciting to see two really strong candidates. I'm particularly personally excited about our first, you know, Native American candidate. But, you know, both candidates are awesome. And I think both of those women bring some really strong commitment to the environment and to the health of their potential constituents.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, Mary. That's Mary Pivetto. And we hope you have a good have you turned in your ballot, actually?
Yes, I did. I still like Election Day. I like to drop my ballot in a box and do Election Day, you know, ceremony. So I did it this afternoon.
Okay, well, thank you for giving us a call tonight. And for anyone who hasn't turned in your ballot yet, you can be like Mary and you can walk that ballot over to your nearest drop box. Have a
good
night, Mary.
Example.
Thank you.
Next, we have up Sean Fleek. Sean, are you there?
Hi, how's it going?
Hi. Thank you for joining us this evening on election night. And as Jenna just said, happy election day to you.
Oh, yeah, I'm real excited about it. I've been following a lot of the local elections pretty closely. Super invested in the national race, but I think there's a lot of really positive things that people can do at the local level. The mayor's election is one I've been tracking really closely. I am also personally really invested in, hopefully, our first ever Native American legislator getting elected this year. Sanchez is an old friend and an awesome woman in the Native community. And as a Native man, I really think it's important that we have representation. I mean, Oregon had a huge concentration of Native American tribes before all the termination began, and the fact that we've never had a legislator isn't particularly surprising, given the history of this country, but I feel like we have a chance to do something about that.
Well, so for our listeners who are just tuning in, we are speaking with Sean Fleek, who is the Development and Communications Coordinator for OPAL, which stands for Organizing People, Activating Leaders. So over at OPAL, what issues are you guys particularly interested in for the elections today?
Well, we are definitely in support of ballot measure for the Portland gas tax. OPAL is the convener and one of the lead organizations for the Transportation Justice Alliance, which is a group of culturally specific organizations as well as mainstream organizations who come together in a really unique capacity where the culturally specific organizations are really on top of the coalition, but the mainstream organizations are on tap for the coalition. So when it comes time to make decisions about what proposals we're going to support and vote to encourage our membership and our communities to support, the culturally specific organizations and organizations like OPAL that concentrate on income communities and communities of color, you know, we really get to set the agenda for the Transportation Justice Alliance. And OPAL has, you know, come out in support of the gas tax just because it is really necessary for us to fund infrastructure in some of our most underserved communities. And you know, if you walk east of 82nd Avenue, you don't have to go very far before you start running into places that don't have sidewalks, streets that are covered in potholes. And, you know, under the rubric of, you know, safe routes to school, but really just general equity, we want to see, you know, our kids be able to walk to their school or to, you know, people to be able to get to work through active and mass transportation in, you know, safe ways. And there's a lot of unsafe infrastructure in this city, and so the gas tax is really an opportunity for Portland to put money where its mouth is and say, you know, if we value equity, if we value the safety of our families, if we value making sure that there aren't some communities that are sacrifice zones while interior Portland continues to see huge investments in infrastructure, then, you know, we're going to have to fund it. And, you know, money doesn't grow on trees, but thankfully, you know, everybody is willing to chip in a little bit every time they fill up their tank. Gas prices are pretty low right now, and, you know, we're a lot higher not too long ago. So I think the gas tax, personally, I think the gas tax just makes sense. As a car-free Portlander and a person who's never had a driver's license or even a learner's permit, but, you know, particularly I think that, you know, the transportation system that we have puts a lot of impacts into our community. You were just speaking to Mary about the impacts of diesel in our communities, but, you know, there's all sorts of other auto emissions. And I think if you're going to drive a car, you should have to pay to make sure that spaces are maintained and that we should be putting money into the general fund through the way that people fuel their cars, which is gasoline.
Yeah, you know, glad you're really speaking about this issue with transportation and communities of color and often how they're very disenfranchised when it comes to transportation. You know, it's like, what is that recently they've been speaking about having the rapid transit going down
Gresham.
Yeah, out from Gresham. Mm-hmm. And the necessity of that in order to get, you know, transportation for these communities so that people can come into the downtown areas, which have seen the most areas of improvement. So how are communities of color really, are they speaking about more than just the roads, but also about our public transport system?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, OPAL, you know, we were founded originally on air toxics work, but, you know, we're an environmental justice organization. We don't just go into communities and tell them what we think. We go and we talk to people about what's most important to them. And when we started talking about air toxics, people very quickly changed the conversation to transportation. They talked about how they were unable to get to work, they were unable to get to church, they were unable to get to the grocery store. And this is people living in North and Northeast Portland who are pretty marginalized, people who are people who are really looking for just a way to get around. And transportation is really the thing that connects us to all the spaces where we live and work and learn and pray and play. And so in order for us to, you know, get around town, we've got to have a transportation system that's flexible, that has more than just the option of having a personal car. Low-income people, myself included, don't necessarily have the resources to be able to afford a car. And so we need a transportation system that really serves us. And I do want to actually revisit what you were saying about the, you know, the transit access in East Portland. only to say that, you know, East Portland itself, people don't necessarily want to get downtown. Getting downtown from East Portland is actually fairly easy because most of our bus lines are designed to deliver people to the center of the city where all the infrastructure that they've already built is. But getting north-south in East Portland is an entirely different story. If you're just trying to get from outer southeast Portland to outer northeast Portland, there's a 100-block span between 182nd and downtown Gresham where there are no north-south services whatsoever. So in order to make any trip north-south, you actually have to do a horseshoe trip where you travel really far to the west and then north and then really far to the east just to get back. And so that's what makes the extension of transfer times a really high priority for us. We want people to be able to stay on the system longer because as people are being displaced into East Portland, they actually don't have access to the same resources of being able to get north-south, and so they're wasting a whole bunch of their transfer time just to make up the difference. And so until we can extend service and actually improve service in those areas, it's really a no-brainer that we need to make sure that the service that we have lets people ride for long enough to actually get where they're trying to go.
Another thing that you brought up earlier was about how, as I'm just making all sorts of noises into a microphone here, sorry, you guys. But the possible election of the first Native person to the Oregon legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the significance of that for the Native American community here in Oregon?
Yeah, certainly. I had the distinct pleasure of working closely with Tana Sanchez when I was at the Native American Youth and Family Center. And just personally, Tana is an amazing advocate and a really wonderful woman who is more than qualified, is overly experienced in policy. She's been an international indigenous rights activist. She did the March from Alcatraz. I mean, she's just a really powerful woman, and to be in her presence is to really get a sense of what it is to know your elders. And she's highly respected in the Native American community just as a person, but to even take a step back from that and to think about how Oregon has an amazing wealth of tribes that have been here since time immemorial, and yet not one Native person, one person who identifies himself as Native, has ever been elected to our state legislature. And then you think about, what does that mean for the laws of our state or the systems of how our state operates? And you can see it in all the disparities that Native people in the state of Oregon are facing. You see it in the highest percentage of expulsion and dropping out from our high schools, and Oregon's already doing a horrible job in our high schools, so this is just one step worse. We have, the Native community has a higher rate of overrepresentation in the foster care system than any other ethnic group. It's really a travesty how many of the Native community's children are taken away from their homes. And, you see it in just the economic opportunity that's not available. The Native community has some of the highest rates of poverty as any other ethnic group. And that comes down to what our representatives are actually willing to do for us, whether or not they're willing to go to the mat for us. And we've heard, time and again, so many legislators, this is Oregon, and we get a Democratic majority, and that's suddenly supposed to fix our problems, and people are so committed to equity, or so they say. But then when it comes time to actually make investments that are targeted to support low-income communities and communities of color, time and again, those concerns get brushed aside. People will poo-poo the need for an organization like the Native American Youth Family Center. And, frankly, it's kind of disgusting. Like, we need resources directed specifically toward Native people, and we haven't really gotten everything that we need because the disparity still exists in a really massive way. So in order to, improve this situation, we have to make sure that our representatives look like the people that they're supposed to serve. And
absolutely,
of the thousands of people that have ever been elected to our legislature, not one has ever been a Native person. And that's why I personally am very supportive of Tana's candidacy, and I was proud to cast my vote for her because I live in her district.
It's definitely long overdue for the Native Americans to be represented properly in the, not just local government, but nationwide. One other question, what's the climate amongst Native Americans here in Portland and abroad?
When you say the climate,
what's their energy like? I guess specifically around the Native American candidate for the first time.
Well,
how are they feeling?
Well, I mean, what we know is Native people vote, for sure. Mm-hmm. Native people turn out in droves. Mm-hmm. One of the most successful examples of a write-in candidacy in the history of this country was when Lisa Murkowski in Alaska ran a write-in campaign when she was no longer the Republican nominee. And she largely credits Native American people in Alaska with actually taking up her banner and helping her get elected. We know that Native people participate. The problem, I think, is that a lot of us get demographically mislabeled. You know, I've worked on a lot of campaigns myself. There's a database that exists. It's called the Voter Activation Network. And in that database, you can look for people by gender, by birthday, by how often they vote. You know, find people with telephone numbers to make phone calls, which I'm sure a lot of campaign staffers who are potentially listening to this are really sick of thinking about the Voter Activation Network right now. It's the tool that everybody uses to get people elected. Unfortunately, in the Voter Activation Network, there are only about 700 people identified as Native American in the entire city of Portland. The first time I ever looked myself up in there, I was qualified as German or something like that. And so we're really a demographic that's often overlooked. And political campaigns can't really focus on us because they don't necessarily have the tools to seek out our vote, to seek out our issues. But Native people are definitely highly, highly civically engaged. We have definitely, you know, run voter registration drives in, you know, targeting Native communities to talk about the issues that are important to us, like education and homes and foster care. And I think that Native people can definitely turn out in droves. I mean, when I volunteered for Tana's campaign, there were Native people, you know, walking the door, ready to grab a clipboard, ready to go outside and knock on doors for Tana. And I'm just really hoping that, you know, the 40,000 plus Native people that live in Portland, you know, have thought long and hard about this race, and the ones that live in Tana's district race to vote for.
Sean Fleek, thank you so much for taking the time this evening on election night to speak with us. We've been speaking with Sean Fleek for Opal. Thank you again, Sean, for taking time to talk with us, and good luck.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
So up next, on the call for live interview, we have Bruce Poinsett.
Poinsett.
Bruce, are you there?
I'm here.
Sorry for getting your name, your last name incorrect.
It's all right.
So how are you doing this election day? Have you voted yet?
Happy election day.
Oh, yes, I've voted yesterday.
Look at that. Someone who is not a procrastinator. He's on top of stuff. So, Bruce, you're a writer here in Portland, correct?
I am.
So what issues are you looking at particularly today?
Well, when I look at Oregon, I guess things I would see, there's a lot of issues, but I look at, you know, the houseless crisis, jobs is always an issue, and that's something that just brings closer to me personally, is just education.
What particularly about education is the issue that you're looking at?
Well, I point to three things. First is school discipline, which I know Lisa did a big piece a few years ago on, and just the issues of, you know, what are our policies dealing with children who, you know, quote unquote, or, well, not quote unquote, but children who misbehave. I know Portland Public Schools has a thing now where they're trying to do everything they can not to take the child out of the class. And in some ways that works, in some ways that doesn't. And basically we have to look at, you know, how do we engage children? How do we make this important? And then after discipline, I also look at just funding for, you know, extracurriculars, like, you know, arts programs, obviously, and a lot of things that keeps children in school who might otherwise just completely give in to disinterest to, you know, common core subjects. And then the last thing I see is just diversity amongst teachers, which, you know, is a big, you know, buzz topic. And it's not something that can, you know, be fixed overnight. It does take pipeline programs. It does take, you know, how do we reach people at a young age to get them interested into the profession? So, yeah, in terms of education, those are the three things I really focus on.
Bruce, and I don't think we had a chance to have you doing a quick introduction, but for those who are just tuning in and listening and aren't quite familiar with who you are, just give a quick background on who you are. You're a writer, right?
Yeah, I'm a freelance writer. Mm-hmm. I used to work at the Scanner newspaper as a reporter for a couple of years. I do, you know, I work for nonprofits. I guess the last big thing I've had that's been published was doing case studies for the state of Black Oregon for the Urban League. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, like I said, I work with, you know, universities, you know, foundations, nonprofits. I do some journalism. Basically, whatever someone needs. Writing I can do.
So to get back to the discussion around Portland Public Schools and asking the questions about the youth, in your opinion, Mr. Poinsett, where do you think parents play a role, in an active role in making sure that their child's education is not interrupted and that they and that they're given a fair chance? Where do you think the parents play a role in this? Because we hear a lot about, you know, teachers and their duties, but where are the duties on the parents' role, in your opinion?
To be honest, I think parents play just as important, if not more of an important role, because, I mean, teachers, they get, you know, they have these kids for, 8-9 hours out of the day, and you know, if that's not, you know, in blocks where in some cases they just have them for, you know, a couple of hours and then they move on to, you know, the next session or whatever. But, yeah, I can just go from, I'll use my example, for instance, and, you know, I wasn't in Portland Public Schools, but my mother worked in Portland Public Schools for, I want to say, about 3 decades now. And one of the things she did with, you know, my teachers was she always tried to stay involved even though she didn't have a lot of time. And I had to deal with, you know, a lot of stuff where, you know, teachers would purposefully not educate me, for lack of better terms. So it took a lot of pressure on her part to, A, you know, stay in the teacher's ear so that wouldn't happen, and B, just to instill in me why education is so important and why, you know, why I need to take school seriously. And that, in many cases, if, you know, if the parent really isn't on that and you're expecting the teacher to, you know, fill that hole, that's not realistic.
Mm-hmm. And I sort of want to shift gears, so it's a little bit related, because there are some people in our community that don't have the luxury of having a parent. It's a weird word to use to describe a parent, but there are a lot of youth that are houseless. And in your work, you're a freelance journalist. You've worked with nonprofits, so you know what it's like on the ground, on the streets. What issues do you see as underrepresented in Oregon or in Portland, and what do you want to see changed in this election?
Then what issues besides what I mentioned earlier?
Yeah, sort of aside from education.
Well, yeah, I go back to, I said I'm not going to try and pretend like I'm an expert on policy as far as the houseless crisis, but it is a growing issue. And one of the things that does contribute to it is the fact that we are, you know, pricing more and more people out of Portland, or more and more people just out of being able to afford housing, period. And like I said, rising rents is obviously is a big issue. And we have to, it just seems like we're in this kind of out of control cycle of trying to, you know, develop Portland without really in just a very unsustainable way. So, yeah, in terms of really attacking gentrification on that front, I think is a major issue. And then once again, you go back to just jobs is always getting more people working, getting more people who are able to afford housing or get better, even improve pay at their jobs so they can better afford housing, better afford, you know, just the daily things we need.
You know, we're just about out of time. So thank you very much, Bruce, for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's Bruce Poinsett, and he's a writer here in Portland, Oregon. Oh, I got something from Selena real quick.
Yes, and I just want to give a quick update on the Clinton and Sanders battle in Kentucky. Kentucky and Oregon are having same primaries.
Yep.
This evening.
Yeah,
so
they're having their primaries today, too.
Yes. So former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders are in dead heat in the Kentucky Democratic primary with about 92% of the vote counted. If Clinton ekes out a win, it will be an important, if symbolic, victory for her. The delegate allocation in the state will be a wash, but she needs to arrest Sanders' momentum after his victories in Indiana and Virginia the past 2 weeks. And she will have done it in the state, white working class, of course, that has good demographics for Sanders. So this is an update report from the Oregonian. And I think we have another interviewee online.
Next we're going to do a little bit of a special here. So late last month, Cable Evening News Director Lisa Loving called up Spencer Sunshine, a research and activist with progressive think tank Political Research Associates. So here in Oregon, we're going to play an interview with Lisa Loving speaking with Spencer Sunshine about the political and social climate in rural Oregon.
We think that there are at least 14 Patriot Movement-like candidates for office in Oregon, and probably half dozen or a dozen more who we're not aware of or not quite sure about. So there's a major move to run for office right now.
What does it mean if someone is part of the Oregon Patriot Movement? Can you define that as a movement?
First, most of these people, not all, but most of them are running inside the Republican Party. There's a move to take over, and I believe in a couple counties they really have, in Cripp County, for example, have taken over the county Republican Party. Patriot Movement is the successor to the militia movement, which of the 1990s, which itself was sort of a repetition of some earlier political trends, such as the Posse Comitatus movement in the 1970s. It's a radical right-wing movement. It seeks to overturn the political and legal system as we know it in the U.S., and it wants to create a form of radical right-wing decentralization where very little of the federal government power remains, in which there's almost no regulation of a capitalist system, and all of the levers of which we're used to correct for social inequities, for racial bias or anything, or for a safety security net are going to be removed. And the tactic they're best known for is deploying paramilitary formations. In the 90s, these were militias, that's why it was the militia movement, but now we're seeing a whole bunch of different kinds of more decentralized paramilitary formations around, which is why we're seeing like armed action down at the Mosher National Wildlife Refuge.
And as you're doing your research into the Oregon Patriot Movement running for office, what offices are people from the Patriot Movement, as far as you can tell, running for?
Mostly county-level offices. They have a real fixation on the county as a political structure they want to take over. The constitutional sheriffs are almost always county sheriffs. But most of the positions they're running for in this election are county commission positions. Or county judge, which is in Crook and in Harney, the name that's essentially a chair of the county commission. So they're trying to take over county commissions. And then once they're in the county commission, they're trying to get the counties, they have the authority. There's this crank legal strategy called coordination. They claim that the counties can tell the feds what to do with the land. This isn't true, but this is the tactic they try. There are a couple people running for state senate, state rep, and some gubernatorial candidates as well.
How did you come to this issue, and what part of it do you really study?
I started monitoring neo-Nazi and crypto-fascist movements a number of years ago, we were very interested that they were trying to cross-recruit from left-wing movements and ecological movements. Through that, I ran into the Oath Keepers, who are one of the major patriot movement groups. They were coming to Occupy Wall Street demonstrations and trying to recruit from people at Occupy, and they were trying to do, in Southern Oregon, for example, there was a group called Panda, which was trying to unite people from Occupy Wall Street and people from the Tea Party to get county governments to oppose the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. And then what happened last year, there was a conflict in Southern Oregon in Duskin County, a little north of Grants Pass by Marlin, Oregon, between some miners and the Bureau of Land Management. This had actually been a dispute that had been going on for a few years. But this specific case, BLM told some miners they had erected a building. They'd done some work on their claim, made structures, and the BLM said, "We think you're in violation. Here's some paperwork. You have to return it." And instead of returning the paperwork, they called their buddies in the Patriot Movement, local Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, people from around the country, to come and establish armed camps to hold the BLM off. The miners claimed, at the end of the day, they really were claiming the BLM had no jurisdiction and that the miners essentially owned these mining claims as if they were private property, that they could treat them as if they were private property. So this alerted some people in Oregon with the Rural Organizing Project. This really wonderful group in Oregon has 50 local groups outside of Portland in the rural and small town part of the states. They contacted the think tank I work with, PRA, and they said, "Hey, what's going on?" And we said, "Hey, you've got a lot of really crazy Patriot Movement activism there. That movement's supposed to be in decline, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, but it seems like it's in full swing in Oregon." So for the last year, long story short, I've been looking very closely at the Patriot Movement in Oregon. I live in New York, but I spent quite a bit of time going back and forth to Oregon, traveling around the state, talking to people, and investigating the movement.
So, Spencer, the reason this Patriot Movement is growing in power, that just tells me that there's something that's not working very well for local residents in rural areas. What is it that the Patriot Movement organizers are able to capitalize on in recruiting people to their movement?
Well, that's absolutely right. There is real discontent in the rural areas. I think everybody knows this. The rural Oregon was always based on mining, but particularly logging.